You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson in for Rob Ferret. Coming up as we head into 2020, we'll take a look at the news that shaped Wisconsin over the last decade. First, it's not unusual for someone to make learning a new language a resolution for the new year. While it can certainly be a rewarding experience, it can also be a big undertaking. There are things like figuring out unfamiliar pronunciations or understanding verb conjugation, and of course, finding time to focus on learning in the first place. A little earlier this year, we talked with a language instructor who said there's also lots of joy to be found in the process, and she joined us to share some advice on how we can start learning a language at any age. Sage Gellner is an associate professor of French and continuing education at UW-Madison. She's also the chair of the Department of Liberal Arts and Applied Studies. Sage, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Judith, for having me on.
Well, we've recently asked our listeners to tell us about things that they were learning, and language came up from a couple different people. Here's what Eva in Greendale told Central Time host Rob Ferret about why she started learning Korean.
I recently got into K-pop, and usually that's a frowned upon reason to start learning Korean. But I started listening to the music, and I fell in love with the beauty of the language and how complex it was. So I looked into it, I found an app, and some of my friends are learning it too. So I've decided to learn it from them and to use this app to challenge myself and challenge my thinking, especially over this summer.
That's such a cool reason for learning a particular language. What are some of the other reasons you hear from people about why they want to start learning a new language?
I just want to commend the person who's learning Korean and say that K-pop has been really influential in Korean enrollments in our evening programs. Korean is having a resurgence. So there's a proverb that goes that you live a new life for each language that you speak. And that's really, I think, one of the main reasons people want to learn new languages. In the courses I teach and oversee, a lot of people are traveling and they want to be able to connect more deeply with the people and the cultures.
Actually be able to interact.
Yeah. Be able to interact. Traveling to places like Italy, France, and my colleague does courses in Spanish, so Spain and Latin America. Definitely, that's a reason. There are also ancestry reasons. Many of our many people in Wisconsin have German heritage and want to learn about their family tree. Want to read old letters, so they will pick up German. Those are just some of the many reasons.
And does it matter why we want to learn, how we might want to go about it? Like if it's for travel, maybe we want to focus on really useful everyday terminology. But if we're like really drawn to maybe a form of literature, that's a very different type of language. Is that something to take into account when you're deciding?
Absolutely. I think not only you want to think about the language that pulls you, that calls you, but also the reasons why you want to learn it and to make that endeavor meaningful to you. So if your goal is to read Proust, then you're going to be your learning style. You're going to tailor your learning style differently. You're going to do a lot of reading as opposed to listening, for example, working on your vocabulary and such. If your goal is to communicate with your mother-in-law, because that's another reason people learn a language is because they have bicultural spouses or families, the things you are learning will be different, but the key is to make it meaningful for your learning.
What are some realistic goals to set as we're starting out learning a new language? I mean, reading Proust is a pretty lofty goal. And I studied Russian for a long time, and there's a lot of Russian literature that I know I am never going to be able to read. I'm never going to be at that level. What are some good, really concrete goals that we can feel a sense of accomplishment fairly quickly?
Well, I think goal setting is great, and keeping them easy and fun, keeping your preliminary goals easy and fun is really key. Greetings, weather, colors, feelings, These are things that we can attain easily. And I also think memorizing the words to your favorite song in the language you're studying is a nice goal to have. And really, when you're starting out learning a language as an adult, I think it's really helpful to start with listening and to just have music, news, podcasts, all kinds of, you know, audio in the background, because our brains really need to get used to the sounds and rhythms of the new language.
We're talking with Sage Gellner right now. She's an associate professor of French and continuing education at UW-Madison. And we're talking about the joy of learning languages at a, we'll say, older age, out of school age, and ways to go about it, because it can be a little intimidating. So, Sage, let's say I wake up tomorrow, actually every day I wake up and think that I would love to study a new language. What if I think, okay, this is the year I'm going to do it. I'm going to start. What's a good way to start?
I start by taking the first step, whatever that is for you. If it's tuning your radio to your favorite station, whether it's signing up for the evening class, whether it's finding a language table in your community, or looking on meetup.com for a language partner. It could be, the first step could be labeling your silverware in the target language and your household furnishings.
There used to be a whole series of workbooks that had those stickers for everything.
Yes.
And I never used them all, but I just, you know, had this image of like, you literally couldn't look at anything or pick up anything without a little label.
That's right.
On your toothbrush and on the oven and things like that.
And not just reading it, but saying it
right
when you touch it. Yeah.
So what if we maybe studied a language years and years ago in school, but haven't really done anything with it? Does that give you a little bit of a leg up if you go back to it, even if it's decades later?
Absolutely. I have an older gentleman who came back to French, took a course with me at the French House after 40 years, I think. He had taken French in high school and not spoken a word of it since. And he had a wonderful time just reconnecting with the language and remembering things and the fun turns of phrase and the ways that we express things differently in different languages.
Is there something to be said for learning a language because we want to instead of because we have to? I'm thinking, you know, yes, maybe there are quizzes and tests in the maybe the app that you're using to learn or the class that you're taking, but that's not going on a report card that is, you know, going to follow you for however long. It's a way to gauge yourself, but it takes some of the pressure off.
Yeah, I think I feel that a lot, that intrinsic motivation, because I work mostly with returning adult students and they want to come to this class because they want to learn French. And same goes for my colleagues in German and Spanish and Portuguese and the whole list of the languages that we offer at UW in the evening classes, continuing studies. It's really that meaningful motivation that really keeps you connected with your project of learning your language.
Let's go to the phones, and Judy in Milwaukee is up. Hi, Judy.
Hello there.
Hi, what would you like to share?
I would like to share that I am having a marvelous time learning sign language with one of my grandchildren. We now play games like Go Fish, using sign numbers to ask for each other's cards and the fish sign for Go Fish. But it's more than that. And I just picked up a book, brought it over there. When we're together, we learn some vocabulary. And I think it's been a great way. And I know it's learning a language is preventative for Alzheimer's. So all good.
That's wonderful. How old is your grandchild that you're doing this with, Judy?
We started this when she was 4.5, and she will be 7.
Wow.
So we have quite a vocabulary that we can... we can share.
And had you always been interested in sign language? How did you choose that language in particular?
It was more, what would I have time to do? And because I do babysit with her, I had the time already in my calendar. So it was perfect. Besides, she's very quick and she loves it.
Wow. Well, that's just a wonderful story. Thank you for sharing that with us, Judy. Sage, that hits so many of the great reasons to share with someone you care about, to, as she said, prevent, decline mentally. And now I'm sure that Judy can also interact with deaf people who she wouldn't normally be able to communicate with.
And I think that's a language that we often overlook. American Sign Language, and there's a great need for interpreters and people who can speak that language. I also think it's a really fun language to think about learning, because it's motion and speaking. And so when we're thinking about cognitive benefits of learning things as we age and neuroplasticity of the brain, combining movement with language learning is really powerful.
We're listening back to a conversation with Sage Gellner, Associate Professor of French and Continuing Education at UW-Madison. We're talking about how to learn a new language at any age. And we want to hear from you. Is learning a new language one of your New Year's resolutions? Are you learning a new language right now? And if so, how's it going? What challenges have you run into? If you want to learn a new language but haven't gotten started yet, what are some of the things that have gotten in your way? Send us an email at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Right now, we're listening back to our conversation with Sage Gellner about learning a new language. She's an associate professor of French and continuing education at UW-Madison and the chair of the Department of Liberal Arts and Applied Studies. And we want to hear from you. Have you ever tried to learn a new language? Were there learning techniques or tricks that really helped you learn it? Or maybe some that didn't? You can let us know by emailing us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And we heard that little clip from our listener, Eva, from Greendale earlier. She mentioned a language app that she's using. What do we know about how useful apps and other software is for language learning?
We know that they can be very useful as additions to your project. My students swear by Duolingo. They use it, and it's a fun little app. It's free, and it gamifies your learning experience, so you actually level up. And if you don't do the app, one day the owl gets a sad face, and so it incorporates that sort of play into the language. And so there's that one, but there are myriad other apps that can help, and just what we can do with technology these days. There are YouTube tutorials on pronunciation of certain things that are hard for English speakers to do, for example. Podcasts. It's pretty exciting.
I've also heard there's something that I think it's called Slow News, and I think it's in not a lot of languages, but it's current events news at half the speed, I believe. So if you want to kind of incorporate staying up to date on what's going on in the world, but also practice your language, it sounds like there are things like that as well.
That's a fantastic resource, and one that I recommend often. And the reason why I recommend it, why it works so well, is that it stays when you're learning something new. There's the comfort zone, there's the learning zone, and then there's the panic zone. And when you listen to real time, let's say Spanish news, you're in the panic zone. You're not getting it. And we don't take into account the role that emotion can play in our language learning. So the news in slow French or news in slow Spanish is great because it's right in our learning zone. And there's even a transcript of the spoken part, so you can go back and catch things you might have missed.
And I will say that one of the best situations, and it's not always easy to find, is when you can watch a movie in a language that you're learning and see subtitles in that same language instead of in English. So it's the same kind of thing. You're hearing it and you're reading it, and they don't always match up. I have noticed that.
Yeah.
But that, to me, I always know that I'm learning in those situations.
Yeah, that's really helpful, because as you know, the reading skills come faster generally for people than the listening skills. So to have that extra scaffolding in the form of the subtitle is great.
We're talking with Sage Gellner right now about learning languages as an adult. She's an associate professor of French and continuing education at UW-Madison. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And let's go to Jerry in Johnson Creek. Hi, Jerry. Oh, we lost Jerry. Let's go to Ben in Toma instead. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead.
I had an opportunity to live and work in Peru a while ago, and I learned Spanish, you know, via just immersion, and it was rapid, you know, 3 months, really uncomfortable after that. It was good, but then I came back, I wanted to learn, you know, something else, and I was looking into German, but I just find it so difficult to, you know, learn the language without somebody to speak it with, without, like, that immersion experience that I had when I was in Peru, and I kind of just dropped it, unfortunately. But then what would you say, like, what kind of resources are there out there for you know, looking for, like, a language partner or someone to speak the language with, people like me who want to learn but find it difficult without that?
Sure. Thanks for that, Ben. And yeah, definitely there's nothing like an immersion experience, but for many, many reasons, that's not always possible. What's kind of the next best thing, Sage?
So you mentioned a language partner, and I talked about meetup.com earlier in the program. I think I haven't explored this, but I think there are virtual conversation partners. You can you can meet with people either for free or for a small fee via Skype or other video conferencing. There are people who do that professionally now. That's like one-on-one tutoring. So that's one way. And another thing that I think we don't think about often is foreign exchange students. It's a way to, if you can't go there, it's a way to bring your target language and your target culture to you. Of course, that person, that youth is wanting to learn English, right. So you're not going to be speaking German the whole time. But it just puts you in that sort of bilingual or thinking about how do I say this in German mindset. And you don't have to do a program for a whole year and invite somebody for a whole year. There are summer, you know, month-long programs, things like that. So
great. Well, good luck with that. And we do have Jerry on the line, so let's go to Jerry in Johnson Creek. Hi, Jerry.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi.
It's really an excellent program to listen to, and your speaker is right on. I am 70 years old. I started to study Spanish a year and a half ago, and I use multiple tools to learn. Sometimes I will spend 8 hours a day just learning it because it's so exciting and fun.
Wow.
But Duolingo is absolutely, I've used many, and I still use many apps. Duolingo is absolutely the best. I have a tutor in Costa Rica. I read all sorts of books. I finally met a neighbor while I was on my bike who is Mexican. She's coming over here tomorrow morning so that we can talk to each other.
And Jerry, I'm going to tell you something. We were actually going to play a clip of you calling into the show when we talked about learning new things, and you talked exactly about learning Spanish, and that was one of our inspirations for doing this segment. So thank you for that. And Jerry is having a great time learning Spanish. It sounds like.
Yes, Jerry, you're doing it. Just the way you need to do it. A lot of times I think we want to have a silver bullet or a one-size-fits-all approach to, oh, if I just go to X country for 3 months, I'll be fluent. And that's not the case. It's exactly what Jerry's doing. It's taking a multiple pathways to in this pursuit of this meaningful project for you and having fun while you're doing it.
And I will say one of the most important things I have found in trying to, you know, increase how proficient I am in a language is not being afraid to make mistakes. You just have to speak.
That's right. Yes. Speak before you think you're ready to say something. Don't be afraid to make those mistakes, and we can laugh about it and find the fun in it. I think that's where kids do have an advantage because they're fearless and they don't mind making mistakes, and that's actually where my 60-year-old students also have an advantage. They know how to laugh at themselves and how to pick up and dust themselves off and try again.
Let's go back to the phones, and Amy in Door County is next. Hi, Amy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure, go ahead.
I really respect people that can speak more than one language. I've always felt inhibited to give it a try, you know, post high school, because I would say I know for a fact I don't have a great memory. It feels kind of necessary in learning a new language.
Sage, are there techniques that you give your students to maybe, if people feel like they're just not soaking it in like we feel like we do when we're a kid?
I think it's, yeah, everybody's brain is different. And it sounds like you know your learning style, and you know that it's a challenge for you to remember things. So the key there would be practice and persistence for you, and not to take it too seriously. If you forget something that you've learned already seven times, you've forgotten it, and maybe you'll learn it on the eighth time. Our last mistake is always our greatest teacher.
One of the other things that people can sometimes find difficult, I think, learning a language at an older age is, for instance, some of the things like rolling an R or being able to actually hear exactly what a native speaker is doing with their mouths. Are there any tips for that?
I think, again, practice and persistence are key. Watching yourself pronounce things in the mirror can be very helpful. Imitating, as I said, those YouTube tutorials can help. And again, working with a native speaker. It's okay to have an accent. It's beautiful to have an accent. It's charming to have an accent. We shouldn't try for perfection.
Exactly. And it's pretty unlikely that you won't have an accent. So just
exactly.
accept
yeah.
it and move on.
Yes.
Well, Sage, thanks so much for joining us today. It was a lot of fun.
It was fun for me, too. Thank you very much.
That was Sage Gellner, an associate professor of French and continuing education at UW-Madison. She's also the chair of the Department of Liberal Arts and Applied Studies. We spoke with her earlier this year about the joy of learning a new language and how to get started. Coming up, we'll talk about the major news stories that impacted Wisconsin over the last decade. Stay with us. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 6 on The Morning Show, a Wisconsin writer joins host Keely Boltina to talk about her latest collection of poetry that weaves together the nuanced beauty of the outdoors with a historical indigenous perspective. They'll also talk about what makes for good poetry and the different ways it touches people. That's tomorrow morning at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, a lot has changed in Wisconsin over the last 10 years, from two seemingly very different governors bookending the decade, to the implementation of Act 10, to the neck-and-neck 2016 general election. Wisconsin has seen a lot of happenings since 2010. And for this conversation, we want to invite you to join in by calling 800-642-1234. What news events have stood out to you the most over the last 10 years? What events impacted your community the most? And what news do you think flew under the radar? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We're joined today by Mike Wagner. He's a professor for the University of Wisconsin-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Mike, thanks for joining us on Central Time for the last time in 2019.
Yeah, good to be here.
Good to be here. What a decade it's been.
It's been interesting in a whole host of ways. And the state, I think, has gone through a lot politically, socially, culturally. Really, as we think about all manner of life in Wisconsin, things are different in a lot of ways, same in others, but many notable things have happened over the course of the last decade.
Well, let's start at close to the beginning of the decade, mm-hmm. 9 years ago, the election of Scott Walker.
Right.
What was significant about his election at that time?
I think the election of Governor Walker and the events that happened right after that are probably the defining political moment of the decade in Wisconsin. Governor Walker's election brought with it the passage of Act 10 and ushered in an extraordinarily contentious era of politics in Wisconsin. Some of the research we do at the university's School of Journalism and Mass Communication has shown that maybe a third of Wisconsinites stop talking to somebody about politics because of Act 10 and their opinions about it. 50% stop talking altogether with somebody, and 20% said they stopped talking with a family member. They ended a relationship with a friend or family member due to their views that kind of spilled out of the contentiousness that came from Act 10. And of course, there was the recall election that came after that, and a whole host of other contentious things that have happened in the Wisconsin legislature, and extending to after Governor Walker's time in office as well.
Well, let's zero in on Act 10. We'll certainly go back to some other things that happened during Governor Walker's tenure. But Act 10 was the Wisconsin Budget Repair Bill. This is Representative Peter Barca at a meeting of the Joint Committee on Conference, where a version of Act 10 that was taken out of the state budget was approved, clearing the way for it to be passed by the legislature.
This is a violation of law. This is not just a rule. It is the law. There must be. No, Mr. Chairman, this is a violation of the open meetings law. It requires 24, at least 2 hours notice.
What have you done? Okay.
What have you done? Excuse me.
That was something.
It was, and it was the kind of time in our state's politics where lawmakers would sometimes need an armed escort to get to the dais of cable television talk shows who descended upon Madison when there were all the protests going on in the Capitol around that same time. There were protests over process. There were protests over policy, over the end of collective bargaining on behalf of public employees in Wisconsin, among other things. And it showed the muscle of the Republican Party in the state. It showed it kind of was a signal, I think, of the increasing vitriolic and tense nature of Wisconsin politics that really has waxed and waned a bit, but has not really simmered down overall. It's still a pretty contentious place to practice politics.
There were also some episodes within that Act 10 era that I think very few of us would ever have expected to see. The many, many thousands of protesters descending
right
on the Capitol.
Right.
The Assembly Democrats leaving
the state, right, to try to use the process and the rules to avoid having legislation be able to take place in their absence.
Well, let's listen to the Assembly vote on that budget repair bill that happened in February 2011.
The clerk will close the roll. There are 51 ayes, 17 nays. The bill is passed. Gentlemen for the 69. All in favor say aye. All opposed say nay. The ayes have it. The bill is in the Senate. The Assembly is adjourned.
So that was just about 9 years ago, a little
right
shy of 9 years ago. How strong are the ripple effects of Act 10 still in the state today?
I think they're extraordinarily strong. People still take the feelings they had during that time and apply it to the contemporary politics they see today. I moved to Wisconsin on the day of the recall election. And I remember our neighbors, I live in Madison, and our neighbors telling me you should probably put up a recall Walker sign so that neighbors think that you are on their side. And so we just moved here. We don't even know anything really about Wisconsin politics. But that, you know, that was the intense nature. And there are still recall Walker signs in homes in my neighborhood as I just walk in the neighborhood. So it's something that's stuck with people. It's been a point of pride, I think, for those who passed Act 10 in the legislature and those who supported them. And it's been a rallying cry for liberals, progressives, Wisconsin Democrats ever since.
Oh, and just in the last month, I think the UW hospital nurses have been moving to re-energize their union that had been really hampered by Act 10 legislation.
That's happening in professions, I think, across the state. And I think the Evers administration's election, I think, has been part of what spurred that. And there's been a lot of groups who haven't stopped trying to organize since being on the losing side the first time.
We're talking with Mike Wagner right now. He's a professor for the University of Wisconsin-Madison's School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And we are looking back at some of the biggest news stories of the last decade. You can join in at 800-642-1110. 1234. Switching gears from the political for a bit to a very sad story, we'd be remiss if we didn't talk about the mass shooting at the Sikh temple in Oak Creek in 2012. A 40-year-old gunman shot and killed six people, injured four others in what was ultimately deemed to be a domestic terror incident. How did that affect Wisconsin?
Well, I think it in some ways it devastated Wisconsin, and in other ways it was just another day in Wisconsin, which is to say that when mass shootings happen, there's a devastating set of consequences that people who are surrounding that issue are exposed to. And there's this second conversation that begins to happen primarily on social media, where folks who think we need more gun control and need to find ways to lessen the impact of guns in society begin activism for that. And those who say that gun rights need to be extended also begin the conversation. And some work done out of our department led by a grad student named Yinny Zhang showed that when these kinds of mass shootings take place, the conversation about thoughts and prayers and the conversation about concern for people lasts longer when the victims are white. And it also showed that the conversation in the beginning focuses a little bit more on more progressive issues, but the staying power is on the side of the pro Second Amendment tweeters. And so there's all these different kind of fascinating things happening on social media as the actual devastation of an honest to goodness mass shooting happens, just down the road in Oak Creek.
And there have been other mass shootings in Wisconsin in this decade as well. One of the interesting things I think that came out of the Sikh temple shooting is that the son of one of the people who was killed has joined forces with a former white supremacist, and they are working very closely together, and especially with young people, to try to prevent this kind of violence. And I like to think that that's one of the very positive ripples out of that very sad story.
I think that's true, and I think it's true with a lot of different kinds of sad stories, whether it's ones related to the horrors of mass shooting events, and also ones related to, say, the opioid crisis in Wisconsin, where Representative Nygren has been a leader in that fight, while at the same time dealing with family issues related to that fight. And so I think a lot of times, the darkest things that happen can generate positive momentum. It's just whether others join in, whether lawmakers join in, whether activists get on board and stay on board, to stay in the conversation in the news, to stay in the conversation on social media, to stay in the conversation between friends and family, to put pressure to bear on folks who make the decisions about what our laws are going to be.
You just mentioned the opioid crisis, and certainly that has really dominated the news for several of the years in this decade. And in January 2015, the Center for Investigative Reporting released a series of reports detailing allegations that the Veterans Affairs Hospital in Toma was overprescribing medications with really disastrous and tragic results, overdoses and deaths of veterans, and of some veterans who sought the care of a particular doctor there who became known as the Candyman.
The Candyman, that's right.
So where are we at with this? I mean, this was journalism at its best, really helping some of the most vulnerable people.
It's an example of the kind of work that folks like the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism do, folks here and public media in Wisconsin do, and others that really shine lights on elements of what's happening in our society that people need to know about and put pressure on our decision makers to do something about. And we had the secretary of the VA come in and say, this kind of thing has to stop. And it's time to put resources in place to make it so places like VA hospitals are not places where these kinds of medications are overprescribed, dangerously prescribed, and given out with impunity and lack of thought to the people that they're giving them to.
And it's also interesting that that story came out, at least in the beginning, because of a whistleblower.
Right. As so many investigative stories do, including the impeachment situation we're witnessing now at the federal level, whistleblowers are crucial to investigative journalism and often crucial to the maintenance and success of democracies.
Mike Wagner is with us right now. He's a professor in the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And we're talking about the decade of Wisconsin news and how it's shaped us as a state. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. 1234. What were some of the biggest issues and stories for you in Wisconsin in the past decade? What were some of the stories that you feel like flew under the radar? And what news impacted your community the most? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. We're continuing our conversation about the news over the past decade that shaped Wisconsin. And our guest is Mike Wagner. He's a professor in UW-Madison's School of Journalism and Mass Communication. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What news do you think impacted Wisconsin the most over the last 10 years? What was the biggest news from your community? And what state news resonated with you the most? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Well, it's hard to even think back a few years, let alone 10 years, but one of the biggest things that happened in the last decade was the 2016 election, President Trump being elected and Wisconsin playing a big role in that. Here's a clip from that election night.
CNN now projects that Donald Trump will carry the state of Wisconsin. He will win Wisconsin with its 10 electoral votes. He's cracked the so-called blue wall that Hillary Clinton had tried to create. Donald Trump wins Wisconsin.
Mike, that was certainly a position that I think a lot of Wisconsinites did not expect to be in, basically calling the election for Donald Trump.
Right. I think Democrats in Wisconsin and nationally had thought Wisconsin was pretty well locked up for Hillary Clinton, so much so that she didn't campaign in Wisconsin during the general election. She came during the primary, was scheduled to come during the general, and I think it was the Orlando nightclub shooting that caused her to cancel her trip to Wisconsin in 2016, or at least the trip she ended up not taking. But it really showed, I think, the nature of politics in Wisconsin and how Governor Walker's roadmap of being able to appeal to voters by letting them know that they can resent particular groups such as, you know, the elites in Madison or people in Milwaukee taking public services, which are kind of hallmarks of the way that Governor Walker would often campaign. Those kinds of things worked for candidate Trump as well, saying he was going to drain the swamp and stick it to those elites and he couldn't be corrupted because he was rich. And some of those arguments played well with some people who voted for Barack Obama and also voted for Donald Trump. You know, you might recall Obama won rural Wisconsin nearly 2-1, and the same is true for Donald Trump in 2016, 2008 for Obama in that regard. And so we saw this big flip, the first time Wisconsin had gone blue since, I think, Ronald Reagan in 1984. And now we see this state where sometimes, you know, we have a Republican senator, one of the more conservative ones, a Democratic senator, one of the more conservative ones, a squeaker of an election that put Governor Evers in office. And so it's a very close state in terms of who wins statewide elections. And I think we'll see the same thing in 2020.
Well, we also saw that really significant group of Wisconsinites in D.C. with Paul Ryan as Speaker, Reince Priebus, and Governor Walker having been, for a brief time, considered a pretty strong presidential candidate.
He was one of the people who was touted as a front runner early on in the campaign, and for good reason. He'd won a blue state. He'd survived a recall, being the first person ever to do that as a governor in our country, and had done so while aggressively advancing conservative policies, and then kind of flamed out in the election as Donald Trump saturated the media, among other things, during the campaign. But then, of course, as you say, Reince Priebus from Wisconsin, first chief of staff, Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House. Wisconsin was centrally a part of the beginning and maybe middle of the first term of Donald Trump's presidency.
We're talking with journalism professor Mike Wagner about the biggest Wisconsin news stories of the last decade. You can join in at 800-642-1234. And John in Winona has something to say. Hi, John. Go ahead.
Okay. I live over in Wisconsin, and the dairy farmers, among other the farmers, they're mostly millionaires. They're not rich because they have the dairy cows and the land. That's why they're millionaires. But they're not voting for the Republicans because of fact that they really took it in the shorts with the foreign policy that the Republican president enacted, and he let the farmers drift in the wind, and they are not voting for him, and he's losing. I think they figured out that there was five farmers that went bankrupt every day since he's been in office. So,
and so John pointing to the fact that we have lost a lot of farms in Wisconsin in the last decade.
Family farms, for sure. Corporate farms are a little healthier, I think, than the family farm has been in our state and other states where family farms had been such a crucial part of the state's economy and culture. And it is the case that the family farm has been suffering in Wisconsin. And in the public opinion polling done by the Marquette University Law Poll, we found breaking down people by region, rural Wisconsinites are not over 50% for President Trump. Suburban Wisconsinites strongly in favor of Trump compared to the rest of the state. But rural Wisconsinites, the president is underwater. Now, we should caution, you know, not all people who live in rural areas are farmers. In fact, most aren't. But the idea that farmers will be strong for Trump is certainly not a foregone conclusion, as the caller was pointing out with his own personal experience and as the evidence from recent public opinion polls show.
Thanks for that call, John. And we certainly need to at least touch on the fact that Tony Evers beat Scott Walker in the 2018 election. I don't think a lot of people on either side thought that that was going to happen.
You know, Governor Walker won his election, then survived the recall, won re-election, and, you know, lost in the election that, you know, we might have thought going in he would have been the least vulnerable, perhaps. But I think one thing that happened was that Governor Walker ran for president. And when he did, he took a big dip in terms of independent voter support in the state. And while he earned some of that back over the last year of his term, he didn't earn it back to the point he was at before he ran. And in an election that was as close as this one, there are 25 reasonable explanations for why a few thousand votes here or there went one way or another. But I think the one that's the most durable and the hardest to beat down with other evidence is that he did not hold independent support in the way that he had in his other races. And it also, I think, stands that, you know, Governor Evers campaigned as a more independent-minded, let's compromise kind of candidate. That the governing hasn't quite worked out that way in our contentious environment, but that was the nature of the campaign.
Before we wrap up, I think we should give a nod to Wisconsin sports teams. We had a Super Bowl victory from the Packers, and the Bucks have been a lot of fun to watch, one of the best teams in the NBA, and a lot of that is thanks to Giannis Antetokounmpo. What shines about him?
Well, he's just he's an amazing athlete, super fun to watch. And, you know, as is the case with most people who are among the best at what they do, he seems obsessed with getting better. And so I think the knock on him, as far as I know, is his outside shooting, and that seems to be improving. But, I mean, the kind of teammate he appears to be and his athleticism and sense of the game are really, you know, it really makes watching, you know, Milwaukee Bucks basketball fun to do. And, you know, it's also the case, you know, Wisconsin's had a lot of athletic success. I think some Rose Bowls, the women's hockey team, I think, made 8 Frozen Fours. Is that right? And 2 national titles over the decade. So a whole lot of success athletics wise.
Yeah. Well, it's been a big decade. We're going to look forward to talking with you in the next year, the next 10 years, as long as we can keep you.
I'll do the same. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Mike. And have a very happy new year.
Happy new year to you, too.
Mike Wagner is a professor in UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. He joined us today to talk about the news that shaped Wisconsin over the last 10 years. You can keep the conversation going over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tell us what stories really resonated with you in the last decade, what stories you think kind of flew under the radar, and also, if you have any predictions for what might be happening in Wisconsin in the months and years to come. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, when we're down with a cold or worse, we often have low energy and are a little depressed. An anthropologist joins us to explain how feeling sick is actually meant to help you get better faster. The science of smell could play a big role in regulations on Wisconsin livestock farms and how manure affects the lives of its neighbors. We'll find out more in a new report from WisContext. And imagine turning your radio to the oldies station in 2050. What songs will you be listening to? We talk about what makes a song a lasting success with a writer who studies the hits. That and more coming up tomorrow on Central Time.